And to also note that the gentleman for whom this lecture series is named is sitting in the audience this evening. Robert Rathbun Wilson was born March 4, 1914, in Frontier, Wyoming. He received his BA and his PhD in 1940 from the University of California at Berkeley. In 1940 and 41, he was at Princeton University, engaged in association with Enrico Fermi in some of the early measurements of neutron-absorbing properties of U-235. At Princeton, he invented the isotron method for separating isotopes of uranium and shortly was in charge of the atomic energy project there. This group moved to Los Alamos Laboratory when it was formed in 1943, where Dr. Wilson directed the cyclotron group and eventually the research division until leaving to join the faculty of Harvard University in 1946. After some work on the design of a cyclotron at Harvard, he moved to Cornell University as director of the Laboratory of Nuclear Studies. There, he and his colleagues built a progression of electron synchrotrons, starting with a 300 MeV machine, then the first strong forcing machine that gave one BeV, culminating in a 12 strong forcing machine that gave one BeV, culminating in a 12 BeV electron synchrotron. With these accelerators, the Cornell group explored the structure of the proton. In 1967, Wilson was appointed by the university's research association to be director of the National Accelerator Laboratory with responsibility for the design and construction of the 200 BeV synchrotron that is now in operation at the 400 BeV level. He also accepted a faculty appointment at the University of Chicago. In 1970, he was awarded the LLD by the University of Notre Dame. He received the Elliott Crescent Medal, Franklin Institute, in 1964, and is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society. In 1973, he won the National Medal of Science Award. Now, I think you can tell from the way I read that that there was a certain portion thereof that was moderately incomprehensible to me. And you therefore might be wondering why I, of all people, have been called upon to introduce Professor Wilson. Well, one thing that wasn't included in that handout from the physics department is that Bob Wilson is also a sculptor of some distinction, and that, thank heavens, we do have in common. In going over that material that I've just read you, I suppose the thing that stood out most in my mind was the fact that Bob Wilson was born in Frontier, Wyoming. I mean, after all, Jackson Pollock was born in Cody, Wyoming. And maybe these things, you know, happen in bunches. I'm not quite sure. But in any case, my research has developed to the best of any authority that I was able to consult that in 1914, Frontier, Wyoming had a population of 743 people. Further research indicates that in 1941, the population of Frontier had declined to 700. This was because, you know, in 41, they had the WPA Writers Project. So we have statistics for that year. If you consult a current Rand McNally map, it will tell you that Frontier now has a population of 300 people. This worries me a little because, you know, ever since Bob left, the place has been on a decline. And he was with us for many years, and I've been avoiding looking up the statistics on what's happened to the population of Ithaca in the last 9 years since Bob left us. But at least he is back with us tonight, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome him this evening as he tells you how a physicist blundered into architecture.
Thank you very much, Jason. I wondered how you were going to do that without automobile bumpers. as I look around this audience, I know vaguely every other person occupying a seat. They're all very dear old, my dearest and oldest friends. My oldest and dearest friends. I don't know quite how to make this getting to that age. How to make that come out right. But there are a number of physicists, and I would like to announce that we're taking over. We're back home. This is Franklin Hall, I presume, for the electrician, Ben Franklin. This was the physics laboratory that I'm standing in, the first physics building at Cornell. This is where we all came from. It's our home, and I am on our ground. I'd like to announce that. And I presume that Professors Nickel and Merritt, the real old-timers, their shades are exuberant at this point. That's just an old Cornellian note. About 10 years ago, as Jason said, I left to become, by a peculiar circumstance, a professor of physics here at Cornell, a naive professor, left to become the director of a large laboratory in Illinois to build a proton synchrotron, which is like a microscope to look at the tiniest bits of matter. And it turns out, for reasons of quantum mechanics, perhaps, that the larger the microscope, the smaller it is that you can see. And this was to be the largest microscope so that we could look the deepest into matter and see the tiniest corners. Now, that's the end of the physics advertisements. I'm not going to bludgeon you, I hope, any further at all on that matter. So we've got that behind us. I think you know what it was that I was that the group that went there was to do, was to build a giant microscope. Now then, when I went there, I did have the feeling that architecture was, and it would be, an important part of it. And perhaps the first reason is that the Congress, before I had been chosen, had allocated $250 million, which seemed to me just like an unbelievably high figure, a terrible way for the government perhaps to waste its money, but there it was, $250 million. But that was not so bad because the machine that was projected to be built there had been studied carefully at the University of California, and the experts had come up with the idea that it should cost $350 million. That even staggered me. But what is important was, given the $250 million that we essentially had in hand, I could see that one half of the costs were going to go into architecture. So that if we were to build this, what was then called a 200 billion volt instrument, at about two-thirds of the cost, we had to look very hard at the cost of the architecture and not let that get out of hand. So for us to be successful there, to have some money left over for the physics, clearly one had to be interested in the architecture. Another thing is that there was to be 7,000 The site that was chosen had some 7,000 acres. I'll show you pictures, be showing you pictures of that presently. And I did have a response, felt that there, when you're the director of such a project, you do have some responsibility that it not become a shambles instantly. And if that is not to happen, that means you are going to be concerned with the architecture. There's another thing, and that is that I am firmly convinced of, that communication between many people does have to do with architecture very much. Whether you're in one building, how you communicate in that building is different than if you're in spread out in a sort of campus style in many buildings. And again, I think that just the direct kind of communication that you have depends on the architecture. There's another kind of communication architecture somehow speaks, and that is the idealism. There is an idealism in architecture. I think if, as in physics, one is concerned with the beauty of what it is that you are creating, that's what one is concerned about in architecture, that if you express that in architecture, then you've communicated that same sense of values to your colleagues who are physicists, and they would then expect to look for simplicity, good lines, good volumes in their physics. It's a way of communicating a message. It has to be. One is a human being. There is a unity in these things. I think that they're related. There's another aspect of architecture that I anticipated, and that is that this was to be something of a window to the world, to use a cliche, and it has been that way. Perhaps 25% of the people coming through do come from abroad, and they're sizing up our physics, and at the same time, they're sizing up our sense of values. And I think that architecture has a lot to say about your values. Another practical note about some kind of an expression has to do with when we physicists left Franklin Hall and went to Rockefeller. We were our usual clods, and what we did with Mr. Rockefeller, I think he had perhaps given him, let's say, $1 million to make the best laboratory possible. The physicist put up the cheapest construction, expecting to have a little left over that they would be able to put into their instruments. And they hoped, by showing how frugal they were, that Mr. Rockefeller, when he saw their frugality, after all, he was noted, I think, for... No, that was Henry Ford who gave the dimes away, but I think... It was Rockefeller. Okay, he was noted. Thank you. He was noted for his generosity with dimes. But somehow see the message and give a little more money so that the instruments would allow physics to proceed. The story is, and I believe it's even true, that Rockefeller came in on the time of dedication, looked at that gorgeous building, which you've all seen, said it's ugly, turned on his heel, walked off, and never came back to Cornell again. And none of this largesse descended either on the physics department or, I believe, from the absence of his name, and other parts on the rest of the campus. And had the physicists paid a little more attention to the architecture of that building, it might have been a beautiful place, and there may have been some practical results of that. Anyway, there's a lesson someplace there. There's another reason, and that is I'm just plain in love with architecture. I'm just thrilled. When I look at that St. Louis Arch, for example, you look up and along it and see that magnificent object It just gives me a tremendous lift. And when I see the Hancock Building in Boston, there's windows flying in all directions. similar structures and bridges elsewhere. It just, or go inside of a Gothic church. I'm just full of the reverence for man, conveyed by the people who had put that up. Well, there's another reason, perhaps, than the last one I will inflict on you, and that is that this site did end up in Illinois. Illinois is perhaps, and you will see in my slides, not distinguished by its natural beauty, and is not one of the vacation centers of the of the United States. And for that reason, if we were to attract good physicists and people to use it, it seemed to me that it would not hurt to do our to give a best shot of trying to put in the best architecture that we could. So when I, there's a long story about how I became the director that I need not go into, but one thing that I did ask as a part of the condition of being the director is that that I did not want any tenure particularly, but I did want to have a free hand within our $250 million with what it was that I did, and that they could fire me at any time that they wanted. If they didn't like something, fire me and get rid of me. Otherwise, not fire me and don't get rid of me. But within that context, I wanted to do what it was that either in a technical direction or in an aesthetic direction within the law. There are, it turns out, a lot of restrictions on how you spend federal funds, of course, but within those restrictions that I didn't want somebody ordering to meet. Well, when I started to take the job, I know that one of the administrators in Washington said about the architecture, which explains a lot of architecture in this country, he said, it isn't necessary that it be cheap, it's only that it has to look cheap. And, and I did say that although we were necessarily constrained by having been cut back from $350 million to this miserable $250, that I did expect, I thought that good architecture should not be expensive. On the other hand, there are occasions when one does have to put in extra expense if you're going to have good architecture. At that time, I think that in general, my idea was that the way to get good architecture was to hire the best architects. It was because it was going to take some time. The state of Illinois had finally won a contest in which every state put forward a site, and I think it was because there was a very powerful senator by the name of Everett Dirksen, in fact, at the time, who made a big difference of whether the site came to that particular state. But it was chosen with a large site, 7,000 acres. It was about 20 miles from a very large, the O'Hare Airport, which made it accessible to all parts of the country on pretty flat and good, too flat, ground. Nevertheless, it was going to, they also put up $20 million to buy from the state, to buy the site from the inhabitants, and that was going to take some time. So in the first period of 6 months, I was continued to work here at Cornell, where we were trying to finish the present synchrotron, which is being extended so beautifully by the physics group here. The first employee, as a matter of fact, is sitting here, Rose Beta. Turned out that she was magnificent. I can't go into it, but somehow the project did start slightly out of under a cloud. There were all sorts of people on the East Coast who weren't speaking to me, would have nothing to do with this project. People on the West Coast were worse. On the other hand, Rose Beta is a big figure, and I don't mean large physically, but idealistically, a large, very large figure in physics who had determined the housing, I believe, of where people had lived at Los Alamos. There was no question that when she spoke, she was listened to, and it was very nice to have Rose listen to her on the telephone. Young man, you be at this such and such a place at such and such an hour. There was no request. It was always an order. And they came from the East Coast or the West Coast. I think Rose didn't realize what power she was wielding and how much I needed that. She's tremendously well organized. The only other employee at the time was Angela Gonzalez, who was an artist that we had in our lab that many of you might know from Germany, the daughter of an artist by the name of Laws, like a prominent clay-esque Berlin artist. And it seemed appropriate between Rose and Angela and myself that we might just handle all of the problems. However, just in case, I was trying very hard to hire Bob Mattias, who had been a graduate of the architecture school. I'd served on his committee, and he had worked in the laboratory. Later, he came to work for us, and sometimes you learn from your colleagues, and I learned a lot about architecture from Bob Mattias. The first thing that we had to do was to choose architect. You have to have a consortium of architects, and I was surprised one day when a Colonel Alexander appeared over in Newman Laboratory to make a presentation to me. And he came in with 15 people from an organization called DUSAF. Maybe if there are any architects present, they would know that this is the firm which consists of a consortium of four firms, Daniel Mann, Johnson, and Mendenhall. Another one was the office of Max Urban, who's an architect, presumably, of some distinction. The firm of Seeley, Stevenson, Value, and Connect, another one. And finally, the George A. Fuller Construction Company. Now then, the only one I had ever heard about was the George A. Fuller Construction Company, because it's a very old firm. They had built the Lincoln Memorial, for example. And they were also building Fuller Domes. I mean, they were fairly, I know of them, not because of that Fuller, I think it was because of Buckminster Fuller, who's so well known, or used to be so well known here at Cornell. In any case, they came in and explained. They had been chosen by the previous people to make the project, by the Berkeley Group, and they put on, first of all, they put up the tripod. They didn't use a blackboard. We don't have blackboards here. They put up a triangle, and then they made a card presentation. And I'd never seen such a thing. And the first thing that it said was architects. And, I could read. I didn't understand why they needed a card to say architects. And then it said consortium on another card. Well, great. But I was not terribly impressed, except they were wasting a tremendous amount of paper. And it took five of those cards before they got to anything, which was an organization chart, which I found completely nauseating. And they explained their idea was that, I looked carefully at the organization chart. I was not all that innocent, didn't know about such things. And I found one of those typical things, and way off in one corner was R. Wilson, the director of the laboratory. Their idea of the project was, I think, what they called a turnkey operation. They would hire physicists who would work out what the magnets were like, and they would decide how the money was spent and what we needed, and eventually they would hand me a key, and I would turn it, and then the physicist experimenters would flood in and make use of this. That struck me as not a very good idea, and as far as I was concerned, no fun at all. So I looked into these people. It turned out, the physicists here will know, they had built the Green Banks Observatory, which is a tremendous scandal. It was a similar expenditure of money, And after the money was all gone, spent by these very same people, and essentially in this turnkey manner, all he did was spend the money, but there was no observatory, nothing worked, no mirror, and nothing to show for it. So it seemed to me that we shouldn't have this firm of Dusath at all. On the other hand, we wanted to build the machine very rapidly to get back some momentum, and I learned that if we dismissed them and didn't take them, then a whole another year would go before we qualified other consortiums of architects, and that it would be a lost momentum. So we had a big argument about what was their responsibility for this fiasco. And of course, they claimed it was none at all, and besides, only half of their staff had been involved. And not the people to whom I was speaking at all. Okay, finally we did then say, well, I explained to them that I wanted to tell them what to do and how I wanted them to work in a friendly fashion as though they were colleagues with me, and we finally, they agreed upon that. They also agreed that if we didn't, any person, I had great, tremendous power, it seemed to me, but if I didn't like any person of their in their organization, they would replace him by a more friendly person. I thought that was very, very nice of them and made use of it. We finally did decide that, yes, we would have this firm. And then I learned something, that after you've chosen the firm, you then have to establish what the fee is. And that came to me as a bombshell. I mean, many things in this project came to me as bombshells, but the idea of having that I would have to establish the fee. Well, then I tried to find out, well, I mean, we were going to pay the government, of course, you know, pays everybody for everything, pays for all. And so I said, I asked advice from other people, how much for roughly of the $250 million, roughly $125 million going to those people, how much should go as a fee, just a fee into the companies? Well, for 10%, that would be $12 million. That seemed ridiculous. Since they're being paid for everything else, why should they get that much money? Well, wasn't that, maybe $5 million would be appropriate. So I went in, and it turned out I had to go and talk to partners. That is extremely funny. So I offered them $2 million as a first shot. They came back. $10 million was what they would expect, but they came down to $5 million. Knocked down price because of the Green Bank telescope fiasco. And we then had an argument. I didn't budge, but they were at $5 million. Then they said, well, there's no closing, that they didn't care about the project anyway. They would go away. As though we were a couple of Arabs, I think, discussing this matter, and we're a rug. And I said, of course, then we will institute our long years search for a new company, and we parted company. A week later, though, we found an excuse to come back, and as you can imagine, if they were at $5 million and I was at $2 million, somehow we were going to settle at $3 million, which is what we did. But I found that as a kind of an amusing incident, that just a question of standing around with a group of people and... somehow this kind of sums had never, in the physics department, we didn't seem to be dealing with that. Well, another idea I had, and that was really a crazy one, was that of having Science City, where we all live happily in next to the, right next to the project, and in one of these ideal communities. Well, I know Betty Fox well, and her brother, Bob Kramer, is the man who built Reston. So I flew down and looked at Reston, and he explained to me that we thought we might have 5,000 people. Actually, we have 1,500 now. But we thought we would have as many as 5,000 people working at the laboratory, and that just wasn't enough. We needed 50,000 people even to get a start on such a community. And I talked to other people too, and that seemed generally agreed that 5,000 was not enough for any kind of community. So we dropped that idea. But it was fun to look into the idea of establishing your own city. I'll come back to that. Now I'd like to start my slide part of the experiment, of this, not experiment, it's it is an experiment, yes. Oh, let's see. Now, this is the right. The right and the left. I think I want to hit that one. No, I just hit the reverse. I'll try the other one. Ah. I'll try to focus this then. Now, here is the gorgeous, this I'm giving you a before and after, I'm trying to give you a before and after story. On the left, eventually, will come out an aerial photo of the site, I hope. And this is what the way the site appeared when we got here. You can see that it's very flat. Ah, there we are. Is there maybe a pointer? Yes, there is here. That here is the site, and to give you the scale, it's about 5 kilometers or 3 miles across this direction, about the same. The site goes up, around, and down. This is a recent photograph. The bedroom community of Chicago was some distance. Chicago, incidentally, is 30 miles due. The loop is 30 miles due east of the site. The bedroom community has gradually moved out, has reached up here. These are all now houses that used to be farms. They're coming around, as you can see here. To the west of us is the charming little mill town of Batavia on the Fox River. Batavia, which is an honest little city. Another thing that I should mention about this site was that there had been the old town of Weston, located within the confines of the site, a town with about 100 little ticky-tacky houses that I'll show you pictures of presently, but it's located over there. The first thing, here's the machine that we were to build, which is 1.25 miles in diameter, and it seemed nice. You'll notice that here's the only forest on the site right there. It's a remnant of what was called by the French voyageurs, the Great Woods, the Grand Bois, and it's a remnant of that, and it seemed that that ought to be somehow close to where we would have our buildings. That determined the position of the accelerator, and then this is the long diagonal. The beams where you shine the light so that you can look with a microscope into the heart of the particles that we're studying. All of those experimental equipments were out in this area. And it seemed that pretty much determined the position. I might say, though, there was one other bit of woods. Originally put it down a bit so it would go through the woods. And, of course, we moved this. You can see from this picture let me put another picture. This is the site. There are not very many trees. And any trees that you would have, any tree that you had on that site, clearly, you would want to guard with your life. We determined not to cut any down if we could possibly help it. Therefore, we moved the whole accelerator north a few hundred feet to miss those trees. And there are one or two trees that we had. Then we had a road going around, and it wiggled through the trees, so we didn't have to cut any of them down. That turned out to be a terribly expensive gesture because by moving it north, we ran into a bog that you couldn't see from the surface, a peat bog, and we then had to dig all of the peat out of the bog and transport it elsewhere and put good dirt on which a stable accelerator could be built in its place. That was an accident. Here's another picture of of the that. This is a picture looking into this woods that was kept over. So that you can see cornfields and this one rather pleasant woods. Here's another. This was the only water on the site in the kind of a swampy area. And then going past, right through the site, there were these steel poles, which Commonwealth Edison, the local electricity company, had agreed to move from the site. And and we don't seem to go to the next one. Oh, there we are. Now what I'm, before, remember the large circle, if you will. Here's the road that comes over towards Chicago. And we're looking down on the village, the old village of Weston. And here's what the village of Weston looked like at that time. The power poles going right over the top of it. It had been a bankrupt little city, and most of the houses, you can see, they're sort of cheek on jowl, repetition of the same kind of house, had been taken over by some government loan company. I've forgotten the name of it. Here is one of the houses, and you can see how they went on and the absence of trees generally around them. We inherited the village. It was the state had to purchase the homes from those people who owned them. At with $20 million, they I think they spent what seemed to me like a tremendous amount for the farms and for the houses. And so those were the what we had. We had very little money to build the accelerator. So it was over here in this village that we established our laboratories in which to do the work. And what we did was we put up some that are called Butler buildings for some of the first experimental equipment. And then the houses were built all along these streets, very close together, such as these up here, which we've never changed. But it was kind of fun. I found you could move a house, one of those houses, for $2,000. Which is much cheaper than by factor of large by a factor of 10 or 20 than you could build one. And what we did then was to make kind of a park in the center of the village by moving them out. We moved them up against, here are three, you may be able to see them, against this building. They were the offices, and the buildings then were the labs. And then in this area, you can see in about 15 or 17 of the houses all put moved together. These were the houses that were over in here to make what we called the Curia, because it had a large meeting room. It was in a Roman sense, we called it the Curia. And here was these houses moved against one of these buildings, which the universities were incidentally. I should say that we are managed. My bosses are something called the Universities Research Association. And it consists of some 50 universities. Cornell is one, Harvard, University of California, such places where the high-energy research is done. It's essentially a consortium of those universities. Because we're supposed to represent the universities, building an accelerator to be used by people from the universities. J. O'Rear, for example, has done an experiment in our, a very important experiment in our laboratory. And the first thing that I got involved with, we had lots of power poles that you may have noticed in one of the previous slides. And when we took the power, I don't like powers around, we put the power underground. When we took it down, we had the telephone poles left over. So I tried to make a Japanese bridge. This is one where you come up, don't know if you can see it here, stops with a piece of culvert over it, then goes to the opposite direction and back. That's how we got between these two buildings over this little pond that attracted some ducks. This shows the beautiful architecture that I had in mind that I'm telling you about. This was an air building. It was a complete fiasco because it was extremely cold in the wintertime, extremely hot in the summertime, and blew away at the first tornado. that we considered as not what we had in mind, and I don't know whether the spaces and volumes and were exactly the right thing for that anyway. Besides, your ears would pop as you would go in and out of it. This, on the other hand, we were to put our accelerator in a tunnel, so we were building a prototype of that. This was to be covered over with ground, a concrete one, and then over here, sheet metal with corrugations, just a piece of culvert in which you might make a tunnel out of, which was to be 1.25 miles in diameter. And that was the thing that was to be placed over there, but this was right down in this region of this. Well, I want to come back to that culvert a little later, is why I showed the slide. Here was these houses put together, and there was one two-story one behind this, and this was my attempt at beautiful architecture, which I don't suppose is going to impress you very, very much. Those people who know me know that we have a porch on our... Incidentally, in Ithaca, we lived on the gorge just down the street on Stewart Avenue next to the Fall Creek Bridge to the north of that, and we lived in the home of Professor Bosworth. Professor Bosworth, many of you will know, none of you will know, very few of you will know, was the chairman of the architecture department for many years. And I built a porch out and made many changes in the home. Each time I made a change, I had the feeling that I was living under the disapproval of the spirit of Professor Bosworth. But I put the porch... those of people who recognize the porch I have in my home will recognize the railing made out of big pieces of 8 by 10s there. That was my office. You remember in the center, well, what we built was presumably a fire pond so we get water. And because we had to call people to the meetings in the Curia, we took some old farm bells and put them up on some pieces of I-beam to have a bell tower, and that's what it looks like. Across the street, we have, incidentally, we named all of these after Indians or Indian tribes. This was Sauk Street, and the street's going in other directions, Wakansi or Chichipinko, which means old crazy eyes. It was a famous Indian chief. Nearby, but and we had imagined that when we moved away, we eventually planned to move over next to the ring here, that what we would do then would be to use the city of the old village as a place where our visitors from all of the universities in the country would live while they're doing experiments. And that actually has happened. We have a large collaboration with Russians, sometimes reaching as much as 20 Russians and their wives and children who come and live on the site, and they live here. But when the farmers left, there were roughly 40 or 50 farms. They had quite pretty old farmhouses. What we did was then move all of those houses into the across the street to what we call Sauk Center, and that's these homes are then put down sort of willy-nilly at that point. And here they are, looking over this water. I noticed while horseback riding once that there was that if one put a dam across this region, then it would back up considerable water, which it did. There you can see the dam, and made us a lake. Getting water to cool our accelerator turned out to be quite a problem, and this was one of the steps. We felt that any water that fell on the site belonged to us, and this is one of the ways of impounding it. And also, trying to establish some water is always, to me, a pleasant thing, especially in a flat ground, and might add to the attractiveness. Here we are looking over the water, and then these are the old farmhouses, and rather than building new buildings, it turned out to be not much more economical, but then one had the character of the old farmhouses, and I think most people agree that they're more pleasant to live in than, say, the ticky-tacks on the other side of the street over there are not as comfortable. Okay, let's see. This was, I might say that DUSAF, the professional architects, were interested. We were going to spend a lot of money. They were interested in the serious building, naturally, and regarded the village as beneath contempt. And so I became the architect because I liked the idea in the first place and had the opportunity. And one of the places, this was an old sort of Victorian farmhouse, very charming, that had been there originally. It's at these trees right there. And it was the farmhouse having to do with all of this farm that had been there originally. There was one other Victorian house on the site, so I had that one moved over here. And the way I proceeded to do architecture is we had a model builder, very good model builder. His name was Jose Poches, and he would build a model of anything at sort of quarter inch to the foot scale, which is a good enough scale so you can see it. So I had him build a model of the two houses, and then we found that the roofs would line up in a particular way. And then we built this, we designed this just in the model, this part, which is fake. I mean, it's not a Victorian house. But what we were trying to get, I think you can see, is a feeling of Victorian style hotel. And we call then this Aspen East to try to give it some kind of romantic connotations. And that's our local motel. These views are similar. What I'm trying to do now is to lead you over to the Reng. I'd like to leave the village of Weston at this point and get into the serious business of building the machine. Here we come to the main Reng. The Reng is going around here. And one of the characteristics is a canal which carries water. And here you see a typical view of that canal carrying water around the ring to cool something below it, which I'll show you presently. The water comes into a heat exchanger, goes back, and then we put some fountains there. The original purpose of the fountains was to have fountains, so it'd be eau vivante, water in play, and it looked nice. And since the water was coming out at high velocity, you had to do something with it. So we made these series of 24 fountains around the ring. It also turned out then we didn't have to put any chemicals in to purify the water because of the aeration of the water provided by the fountains meant that we could, our architects had, the engineers for the architectural firm, had made a great water purification and device for not having moss grow in and algae grow in the pond, and it turned out that the fountains worked, so we didn't have to build those. So aesthetics wins again. This is what was underneath. This is why the water was flowing around that ring, and it's 1,000 magnets. I only show them to you. Well, that's the heart of the machine, and to show you the bases on which they stand, 1,000 of those castings, which to me as a sculptor was irresistible. And I hope you notice the Art Nouveau lines where this curve the opposite that point, and very, very subtle. Another thing is to make those, we were spending some 50 megawatts in those, in the copper of those magnets, a lot of power coming in, and to bring the power in, the power here is coming in at 340 kilovolts. And instead of having you can see in the distance, the steel poles, I thought that about 20 of those things were also sculpture. That's not architecture. It seemed to me that's sculpture on a large scale. So I designed the power pole. I have to be arrogant in this talk, and I will be. But when I went to Commonwealth Edison and explained to them that I wanted to design the power poles, they looked at me and said, "You don't design our power poles, and we won't do your physics." And seemed very reasonable, with the exception that we had to pay for the power poles. They explained that they had put a lot of research and that no physicist could ever possibly design a power pole because the hurricanes would blow it over. So I agreed with them that there was a problem. And I asked them how they tested their power poles, and they said they put a rope on them and measured how hard it was to pull them over the factory. So I said, okay, I'd build I'd build a power pole of my design, and we'd put it up next to one of their poles, and if it wouldn't take more force to pull it over, we'd build their pole. And I cheated. And you can't see, but there's a guy wire. And because we have lots of space, and because a guy wire will hold up anything, clearly this power pole was stronger than their miserable steel power poles, and somewhat cheaper. And I hope by getting that peculiar shape, this is a laminated wood in a nice curve from which the insulators hang. And it was made out of the tallest pieces of pine that you can get. They come from the Olympic Peninsula. And here's a more romantic view of showing the grasses that began to grow on the site and showing the power poles. That's the signal I'm supposed to change. Oops. Oh, there we are. Now that we're looking, what I want to bring your attention to here, we're looking down at the site. Here's where we were going to have the central laboratory. The beam from this accelerator goes out in this direction to experimental areas out there. And here we are then looking backward, and I think maybe let me try that. Yeah. Yes, here we are looking backward now toward the ring. Here's the ring. The beam is going north, and we're looking backwards. And these are three of the areas where experiments are done. And in particular, I direct your attention now to this building, looking backwards. And here we are, and here's the building. We decided instead of having one tremendous building, which might go from here out to there, be half mile long, which is the conventional way of doing it, instead we'd have a small building that's relatively small, 100 feet by 100 feet, and coming out with many fingers. These are wonder buildings, in which can be shifted around to suit the actual experiments, and that this would be one way. Another thing we decided to do, instead of having a large laboratory, because we were trying hard to save money, we would use porticamps. Porticamps are sort of little boxes about go from here over to the wall. They collapse. You can open up. They're like a trailer without wheels, the best way to describe them. And we set those up to the next to the experiments, and the experimenters then live in, not live, but they have their computers and their controls and their paper and pencils and sit in those while they control the equipment that they have in these long fingers of wonder building sticking out behind. And their targets and magnets and so on are inside the building. And I'm showing you this building because I had the idea that because we had a factory that made concrete structures for the look like big horseshoes to make the tunnel out of, we could use them upside down to make that building out of. That turned out to cost too much, but then I remembered the culvert building, and it turned out we could make this out of culverts. Here's another one, looking a more romantic view of this, looking across this field. This is where we keep our buffalo, and there you see them placidly eating away. And we look, here's the building in the distance. And then here's another view of the building, is showing this these culverts upside down. You can imagine the tunnel section being put upside down and made into a big arc and supported then by these two massive bits of concrete sort of floating over that. And then here's the last view I'll show you of that building. But here is the culvert material joined together in a peculiar way. But that's just culverts as you would put under a road to drain water. And then we painted this surface. These colors were chosen by the Fair Angela. And so that when you drive past the building, you see a blue building. As you come at it going north, as you go south, you see it turn to be a complete red building. Turned out that this, you might have an explosion of liquid hydrogen in the building, which would make the roof go up. And this particular structure is just as strong to resist explosions upwards as it is to resist the snow load downward. It's a nice mechanical structure. Now I'd like to bring your attention to this point over here. which is where we were going to put a bubble chamber. A bubble chamber is a big sphere, there it is, of steel, which in which we were to put fill up with liquid hydrogen. So it had to be very cold and quite strong. And what you do, it's just like a bottle of champagne. When you pull the cork out of the champagne or take off the top of a beer, bottle of beer, it starts to bubble, make bubbles. Well, those bubbles have to start someplace. You gaze at the champagne or beer long enough, you'll see where they start, right in the, usually on little specks of dirt on the side of the glass. But if a particle goes through at high speed, it crushes the gas into particles, and the bubbles will start on those particles, leaving a contrail, if you will, of showing where the particle has been. A physics note, but it's a way that we can tell what the tracks, what the particles are doing. And at first we had the romantic notion that we just have, this was an architectural object, clearly, and we just have it sticking up in the air, and we'd sort of build a building underneath it. And by having it all alone, it would somehow express the function itself. That was a romantic notion, especially it became less romantic when we found that our beam was that we were to study of particles wasn't to be up there. We'd have to put it underground, and it didn't seem that it would look all that beautiful underground. So we gave up that notion, but we still thought we should express it. And our first idea was to have that sphere much larger, four times larger, and we would have a fuller dome up here on top of this particular building. Well, it turned out that in spite of the fact that the Fuller Construction Company made the Fuller domes, what they had learned to do by then was to make them very expensively. We couldn't afford a Fuller dome. So we said, all right, to the architects, you build us the bottom part, and we physicists somehow or another will put up the top part. And so we invented these panels that you see. See those triangular pieces? And what we did was to make them out of beer cans. And we found that there were beer cans all over the site, and thrown into the roads all around. So we asked the local Boy Scouts if they would care to pick up the beer cans, and we would make a building out of them. And indeed, they did. We cleaned up the whole area, and we did quite a bit of research on them. As a matter of fact, it turned out that I think they were 75% beer cans, 25% Coke cans, and other soft drinks. All the beer cans were empty, and 25% of the Coke cans were half full. It was our first piece of research, which we must have some sociological value, but we've got good statistics. If it can be used in the home economics people, we'd be glad to turn over our findings. In any case, we built a machine that would take the top and bottom out of the beer cans so you could see through it. And what we did is we had a plastic, we had a little factory set up to make our coils, which would make use epoxy. And we would buy a colored piece of about a 16th of an inch thick plate of some plastic material that was transparent and could be colored. I've forgotten the actual material into which epoxy would stick. We would paint, and it was a 9-foot roughly triangle on a very level piece of floor at linoleum, just like this one. And we would then paint epoxy on that. Then we put the cans down just next to each other in a hexagonal array. And they, of course, when the epoxy set up, they would stick to the plastic material. Then we would take that off and put another piece of plastic on, paint it with epoxy, and put this thing with the cans back on it. Then, of course, you had what's called a sandwich board with the with the tin can maintaining the distance, and you could see through it and see that color. I think that may show up in, well, here's the actual bubble chamber that we were building under this. It did have a purpose. I think you can see the tin cans. You can see the hexagonal structure looking through the tin cans, and then they have a nice, quite a nice color. Whether you want to compare this to the blue of shark or not is up to you.